You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. In the past few years, we've seen the word conservative applied in a number of ways, from Paul Ryan's economic libertarianism to Rod Dreher's squishy moralism to Mitt Romney's Massachusetts healthcare plan to Steve Bannon's nationalism. It's not surprising that people may wonder if there's any substance to that word at all. To help us think about that, we have on the line with us today an expert in this very subject and the author of a new book called Conservatism, In Search of a Tradition, Fight for a Tradition. Edmund Fawcett worked at The Economist for more than three decades, serving as its chief correspondent in Washington, Paris, Berlin, and Brussels, as well as working as its European and literary editor, and also the author of a book on liberalism with the subtitle The Life of an Idea. Mr. Fawcett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with the easy question here. What is conservatism?
That is the easy question, and you were right to pick yourself up and say it was the fight for a tradition. Conservatism is a practice of politics. It has an outlook. But it isn't itself an ideology or an outlook. It's a long historic practice of politics with parties. You find it in the United States. You find it in Europe. It's completely recognizable. You don't see it before the 19th century. It has many, many, many philosophical antecedents and political traditions to draw on, but you don't see conservatism historically until modern politics begins early in the 19th century. And conservatives are, or at least they start out as it were, the opponents of liberalism. They're the dialectic opponents of liberalism by outlook and in terms of party position and interest. They are the opponents of liberalism. I'm talking about the early 19th century. You see this in the United States. You see it across Europe. Of course, there are many, many differences, but that is the essential framework. If you pin me to say, okay, that sounds great, but, you know, what do conservatives believe in? What are they trying to do? Here, it does get slippery because they, on the whole, are a party of resistance and stability and inertia. And they resist what I would call liberal modernity. Liberal modernity has two components, one sort of social and economic, the arrival of industry, capitalism, urbanization, and the other is the political and social embrace of those changes, which turn society upside down. Liberals very crudely welcome that change, and for a long time, conservatives say, hold on, wait a minute, go slow. Where the practice develops and where things get tricky is that over the course of the 19th century, conservatives see that they have many, many things in common with liberals, notably a resistance to universal democracy and a resistance to what you could call, political vote, and a resistance you could think of in terms of economic democracy, you know, the demands of trade unions, the demands of socialists, the demands of social democracy. So by the end of the 19th century, you have this breed that is still with us and is in many ways the dominant breed, the liberal conservative. So that is my picture of conservatism. It's essentially a historical idea with an outlook that stresses stability. It is highly adaptable and particularly good at stealing other people's clothes.
all while claiming that they're stealing nothing, right?
Absolutely. They're being true to the true faith.
Just doing it the way it's always been done.
Absolutely.
This is not the subject. So your book focuses heavily on primarily on America, France, England, and Germany.
Right.
Now, I think it's fair to say that the conservative sensibility, if we can use that kind of vague phrase, is much stronger in non-Western nations, right? So China, the Middle East, Japan are nations that venerate tradition in the past in a way that the most conservative person in the West does not. So I'm curious as to why the focus on Western Europe and the United States, if you're writing a book on conservatism. And I do exactly the same thing when I teach this. So this is not a criticism. I'm always convicted by sort of the same thing.
Good. No, I think this is important. And I think it raises an important thing about, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about conservatism? I think we need to make a distinction between conservatism as a recognizable political tradition in the West. I mean, if you look at the outliers, you can find it. Look at Russia.
Right.
You have to go quite into the late 19th century before you really find conservatives. And we're talking about a tradition which exists and makes sense only in liberal modernity. So the countries that you're talking about, they're outside the topic. However, there is something very conservative in all those countries, what you call a sensibility. But that's not a political idea. There is something conservative that is completely recognizable. It's universal. It's the wish that we all have for tomorrow to be like today. That's human. It is universal. But it has very little to do directly with political conservatism as we understand it, you know, historical tradition in the West. I think when you break that link with actual history, pinning down conservatism becomes so fluid and verbal, it virtually ceases to mean anything. I mean, if it simply means respecting tradition, then it's virtually an empty phrase, because there are, you know, dozens and dozens of different traditions in different places.
I agree with that, and I think that's a better way of putting it than I do in class, so I'll probably steal that from you.
Mm-hmm.
To keep going on kind of this, what is conservatism at the heart,
sure,
before we get into some of your working it out, if I talk to a kind of old-line conservative, they're going to say, well, conservatism isn't fundamentally a political movement, it's fundamentally an aesthetic movement. Right.
Yes.
So if Roger Scruton were with us right now, that he would want to start there and then build on top of that. And you acknowledge there are people who say that, but you push back on that in the book.
Push back? Well, no, I include them as,
sure.
Again, I mean, if I could tell you a little bit about how I see the story, I think political conservatism develops early in the 19th century as the opponent of liberalism, but soon comes to compromise, to adapt. And indeed, from the late 19th century on, liberal conservatism becomes the dominant force in the West. Indeed, it shapes the societies in which we live. It has done most to shape the societies in which we live. Liberal pretty well on the economy, but very much able to compromise and absorb democracy, both in political and even in economic terms. At the same time, there are two other streams within conservatism, which usually are not the mainstream, but they're the outsiders. And they're outsiders in two different ways. One is those who remain in politics, but on the edge, and complain about the degree of compromise that the mainstream makes with liberal modernity. And throughout the conservative history, there's always been that right, sometimes called the far right, sometimes called the extreme right, sometimes called the radical right, nowadays called the hard right. It's always there. The other element, which you mentioned, are the cultural critics, or ethical and cultural critics of liberal modernity. And they essentially step out of politics. They're not engaged in the classic conservative game, which conservative parties are so good at competing for and winning and holding power They're not engaged in that. They're much more engaged in a kind of Gramscian struggle in universities and the public prints for intellectual successes. And that is a very strong conservative tradition. I mean, in strong, eloquent, indeed, it's often more eloquent than anything that the liberals or the left have come up with. I mean, you look at just in English alone, you look at, you know, the poets Coleridge, T.S. Eliot, you mentioned the aesthetic philosopher Roger Scruton. There are philosophers like Alasdair MacIntyre. They're more political, but still they're essentially social critics, the American and German neoconservatives. These are all people who are deeply concerned in a conservative way with the character of culture and the, as it were, the sort of moral integrity of citizens. They're interesting. They're interesting because that kind of conservative, and they're particularly interesting today. They're very vocal in the United States and very thoughtful, very influential. The conservative critics in the conservative cultural critics in the United States are they're interestingly divided. I mean, there's a further separation, if you will, from worldly concerns. They tend to divide into those who, in a rather Protestant way, if you will, look on the task as reforming an immoral society. And there are others who, in the spirit of Alasdair MacIntyre, you could call the self-exiles. I mean, they believe in the society's irredeemable. You know, the attractions of immoral, material-minded, selfish liberal society is simply too great for fallen humanity to resist. And the task of a true values conservative or cultural critic is to withdraw and create intellectual and cultural ethical safe spaces in which, as it were, the people who have found some kind of recourse from liberalism can escape.
The Rod Dreher's, right, and their Benedictions.
That is absolutely. I mean, Rod Dreher's book is very interesting. It's a good book, interesting book, the Benedict Option. Although the ideas, I have to say, were taken pretty clearly, although not as it were directly. I'm not complaining about non-attribution or anything, but Alasdair MacIntyre had said much the same at greater philosophical depth.
Yeah, I'm largely sympathetic to the claims that are made there. I think they are overestimating the ability of people to withdraw. I don't think that. I think the culture is far too powerful.
It's fantasy.
I live in Amish country, and we see Amish people, you know, obeying traffic laws and riding around with the reflective cones on them. Like, if even the Amish can't escape.
That's it. I mean, it's interesting. And the Amish, I mean, after all, I mean, they have a, you'll correct me, but I mean, it's a 200 years of tradition of en route as separate communities.
Yeah.
As the United States was growing up around them, they were already there. But as it were, to have grown up in a Western society and to try to create your a sort of self-standing, rooted social community, it's a happy dream. It's worthy, and it's admirable in many ways. I'm not religious, but it doesn't matter. I mean, anybody like that who takes a principled stand, and somebody like Rod Dreher, I mean, he's sincere and it's interesting, but it's a pipe dream.
Yeah. No, I agree, although with some sadness. I agree. So I think one of the and I don't remember if you explicitly say this in the book or not, but one of the threads that comes out is that a core component of conservatism is compromise.
Yeah.
And that is certainly not the way conservatives now or in the past have liked to talk about themselves. When I think conservatism today, I think rights. I think people who are pursuing freedom or talk about pursuing freedom. Maybe if we're dealing with kind of the Steve Bannon wing of things and the Donald Trump wing of things, there's some nationalism there. But compromise is really the thread that runs through all of these generations. Why compromise? That does seem to be counter to the rhetoric.
It is counter to the rhetoric. You're absolutely right. but it is not counter to the practical success that conservatives have in winning and keeping power in democratic, liberal democratic societies where numerically the party of the haves, and I'll come back to that, is almost by definition the numerically smaller party. I mean, David Hume, whose ideas fed a strain of conservative thought, pointed out that all government relies on consent. But as it were, you know, those in charge have no chance against a majority that decides it wants to get rid of them. And so conservatives are always aware, you know, they always have that in the back of their minds. In terms of doctrine or policy, is it really true that conservatives are, they don't compromise or they don't bend? They tend not to admit it, but then who does? I mean, I think consistency is something that almost all parties and politicians like to claim. But I don't sense that. I'm just taking an English example. I mean, I'm sure you can help with American ones. But, you know, the conservatives, they've been for free trade. They've been for protection. They've been for low taxes, high taxes, many policies. It's hard to find, certainly, policies on which conservatives over 200 years in many countries have had one single consistent thing they have stuck to.
Yeah, and I have not read your book on liberalism, although I certainly intend to, but I assume there's something similar true on the left, where you have a shifting and moving of goals just as time goes along.
Completely.
Can you talk a little more about the party of the haves? I thought this was an interesting note in your book also.
I said that conservatism was a historical tradition which had parties, followers, thinkers, and an outlook. But of course, also, it has interests. And the first interest that the conservatives stand for is the interests of the haves. And that's easy to misunderstand. It's easy to misunderstand as a sort of simple-minded left-wing claim. It's not. It's rather that looking after the interests of the haves, for several reasons, is the conservatives' first responsibility. If they're not looking after the haves, they're not doing their job. The stability of property is the conservative view, and you know, historically there is good evidence to support them. Stability in property is tightly connected to social stability and indeed to the spreading of prosperity. When I say that they're the party of the haves, remember that who the haves are and what they have changes, in that when conservatism and liberalism first locked horns early in the 19th century, conservatives were the party of land, at least in Europe. They were the landowners. And liberals tended to be the party of industry. And it's oversimplification. Soon, conservatives became the party of both, and indeed of banking. And as prosperity spread, who the haves were greatly spread. The character of property itself spread from land and industrial capital to, Schumpeter made out, to virtual forms, pension funds, and so forth. So being the party of the have is not being a party of landowners. It's something much subtler now.
And I like to think, as someone who tends conservative himself, to say the party of the haves, kind of the generous spin on that is we want to protect what everyone has.
Yes.
And not destroy, in the process of trying to improve, not destroy the good things that already exist.
Absolutely. When I say they're the party of the haves, I stress that who the haves are spreads. There are many haves. I mean, to say that they started out as the party of big property, but they became the party of property big and small.
Right. Well, you're
still are.
Oh, sure. Yeah, certainly the case.
If you look at election results in Europe and the United States, and you look at the Trump, perhaps not 2020, but even this, I suspect it's still true. But if you look at 2016, the Trump vote was essentially a classic Republican vote, with a few marginal changes in salient areas that weren't expected, Democratic areas. The same was true of the Brexit vote in Britain. The same was true of Boris Johnson's election in 2019, where it was a classic Tory vote with a few surprising changes in seats.
So your book, I think, is probably too long for us to work through systematically in our little 40-minute podcast here. What can you pick out? Maybe tell us the conservative you most enjoyed writing about, and then the one that you think is the most important. And if they're the same, that's fine.
A conservative I enjoyed writing about. They were. I called them pre-conservatives because be consistent. But somebody I enjoyed writing about was. I like to do some comparisons. I liked writing about Edmund Burke and de Maistre, who often de Maistre was at the same time. Sort of revolutionary France, mm-hmm. end of the 18th, early 19th century, and I like this in a kind of mischievous way, because Burke, if you ask somebody who is a typical conservative thinker, and they would say, oh, Edmund Burke, just historically, that reply is an invention of the late 19th century. Burke was virtually disregarded. Among conservatives until late in the 19th century, when conservatives, particularly in England, began to scratch their head and say, hey, we need some thinkers. And Burke was kind of recovered out of hundreds of thousands of words of parliamentary speeches and a kind of distillation of conservative philosophy. And so it was fun to sort of deflate that. I mean, this is not remotely original. There are a number of very, very good scholars, Emily Jones and others, who have done the work on this and shown Burke, shown how, as a conservative icon, he's very much a late invention. But he's also contrasted as a profoundly sensible, reliable, prudent, liberal with the deranged, emotional, irrational, and radical, extreme de Maistre. And I kind of deflated that contrast a little bit by showing that each of them were very much into control, the control of rising forces, popular forces, economic forces that they didn't like. Some others that I enjoyed writing about. I enjoyed writing about Bill Buckley. It's partly because as somebody on the liberal left, I in a way detest his politics, but can't help responding to the energy and enthusiasm and the sort of zest with which he went about things. I remember when he was had a television program on public radio, lest we forget. And he was terribly good. There'd be kind of well-meaning people from liberals or left who'd come on, and they'd be rather taken aback at how quick he was and how difficult an opponent. So that was enjoyable. I enjoyed Buckley. So those are two. And then there are characters who, because the book is both not only about writers and thinkers, but also about the politicians. The book has two figures who are, I mean, clearly they were on the conservative side, they were on the right, but are very fascinating. They're idiosyncratic almost, Bismarck and de Gaulle. They were also interesting to write about.
Who do you think is the most important in terms of conservative figures, either politician or thinker? In your book, if our listeners have to pick kind of one conservative to sink down into, who should they focus on?
Can I punch the question back to you? Are you thinking of a political leader or a political thinker? I mean, if I were to be mischievous, but it's not. I mean, if I were to urge somebody to look and see the thinkers who led us to where we are, I would mention in my country Enoch Powell and in your country Pat Buchanan.
Interesting. Okay.
No, what has happened to conservatism is that if you split American conservatism into the Crusaders, you know, the Moro Crusaders, what I call the tribe, which was the Trump, you know, the various elements that came behind Trump and are now behind McConnell. So the Crusaders, the tribe, and the grown-ups. The grown-ups are they're the old kind of liberal conservative mainstream, but they're a very, very sad and defeated bunch now. The Crusaders and the tribe are in the saddle. And the same is true in my country, that the old Thatcher party, of the Tory Thatcher, the Tory Thatcher party, it's vanished. It's now been Brexitized and is in the hands of what I'd call the hard right, this odd combination of globalists, libertarian globalists, and local one nation populists. You have the same thing in your country. And if you want to see where that hard right comes from, go back to the 1970s and 80s, read Pat Buchanan's speeches. If you want to go back to understand where Brexit came from, go back to the 1970s and read Enoch Powell's writings.
No, I was not expecting those names, but I think those
are. You weren't. But I think in terms of where present day conservatism is, I think those thinkers are the important ones. Of course, to call Pat Buchanan a thinker would from somebody with a doctorate would get a sneer. But by thinker, I mean somebody who is a speechwriter and a public controversialist.
Yeah, I haven't read anything he's written in probably the last 5 or 6 years, but he clearly, he is a thinker in that he has ideas and is filtering the world through those ideas.
Absolutely.
So,
and I mean, I say in the book, I mean, it's that if Trump were a movie, Trump would star, but Buchanan would get the writer's credit.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And he was on the Trump bandwagon long before any.
He invented the phrase
else.
Silent majority.
Yeah.
He's there's a lot there.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have a mild criticism, if that's okay. I think this with any history book, there are things that must be left out because there's far too much to ever include. I think there are two names one of them I assume is left out because you're dealing primarily with politics. But the other name that gets left out, I'd really like to know why you didn't include it. So the name that I think is not surprising is there, but I think is probably as important for late 20th century conservatism as anyone else is J.R.R. Tolkien. I think if you have to pick kind of one person who's shaping modern conservative minds,
that's very good.
Tolkien. So you're not writing about literature; you're writing about politics. It makes sense. I mean, you didn't run for office.
No, but I mention writers. No, that's okay.
So Tolkien. The other name is Leo Strauss.
Okay.
So Leo Strauss basically invents great book style education in America. He is in many ways the intellectual founding father of neoconservatism.
I know exactly who Leo Strauss is. My defense of leaving out Leo Strauss would be two. One is I've sort of covered the same territory.
Yes.
In dealing with Carl Schmitt.
Yep. Yeah, the ideas are there, certainly.
So I think that in writing a book of this kind, I mean, I chose exemplary figures who would, as it were, fill a role. And indeed, like casting a movie, there were many possible. You know, you could have many stars in any one for any one role, but you had to choose. Also, I think the great books in the United States was much earlier than Strauss. There was somebody at Columbia.
Revitalizer, right? Strauss and Mortimer Adler are the...
Mortimer Adler, but there was somebody at Columbia even before them whose name's escaping me. Anyway, I mean, that was a very important and great tradition that I don't think Strauss was responsible for. And but a more important point just on Strauss is that... He was a minor voice in neoconservatism. The great voices in neoconservatism were Daniel Bell, Daniel Moynihan, Norman, the more polemical side, gifted as he was, Norman Podhoretz, etc. I think Leo Strauss, there was always something slightly wacky. I mean, it's a Marmite taste, Leo Strauss. If you like your politics kind of vatic and obscure, okay, go for Strauss. But I'm quite a reader. I'm quite a careful reader. I like to kind of say, okay, what's the meat here? And I have actually read quite a bit of Leo Strauss, and I frankly don't know what he's talking about.
I might quote you on him being a wacky writer.
I think there's an awful, forgive my French, but I think there's an awful lot of bullshit there. As for Tolkien, now I think that's very interesting, and you have got me. I think I'm an old man, and I think this is a ear thing. I was educated at school and got as a theology prize Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And the first thing I did when I got back to London from school was to sell them. I have never read Tolkien and have always been allergic to that kind of writing. But I realize that this is my own, as it were, deaf sensibility. I understand that there is something very widespread that people of learning and sensibility respond to.
And you do mention C.S. Lewis, is that right? I seem to remember him. Okay, well, that would be the other kind of fair game character, especially in...
Sohrab Ahmari mentions, he starts with C.S. Lewis. Indeed, there's a great sort of ekphrastic 20 pages in which a lot of figures that I can't make out, whether they're people or gnomes or, whether they're on this planet or some other planet. I mean, the whole thing, I find for serious discussion of ideas, just that, the staging, the very staging of this kind of writing is beyond me.
Well, and it's certainly less the case that American, and I assume English conservatives, are reading Tolkien or Lewis's nonfiction. I doubt they're reading Lewis's medieval historical scholarship or Tolkien's writings on fairy stories and translations of Beowulf and so on. They're all reading the fiction or the popular nonfiction.
I suspect Tories in Britain more reading James Bond novels, but
fair enough. I can't speak to that. Well, anything you would like our listeners to know in wrapping things up here?
No, I'm very pleased to have done this, and I'm pleased to have confronted my cultural gray hairs on Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, which amuses me because in the book I'm reviewing by Sohrab Ahmari, clearly C.S. Lewis is one of his heroes. And this is part of the culture. It is something that clearly people strongly relate to.
Again, with the conservative concern with aesthetics and the imagination, that's not unreasonable. Anything you'd like our listeners to hear?
I suppose on that, I would simply wrap up by suggesting that, one of the big difficulties, I think, with a lot of what a lot of cultural criticism, ethical and cultural criticism of liberal society, which we label conservative, and you know probably rightly, because it is used for partisan purposes, indeed sometimes written, often written with partisan intent. I think, speaking as a liberal, left-wing liberal, I often think to myself, scrutiny is a good example, but heavens, on almost all the aesthetic points you are making, I don't disagree. So I'm wary about the slippage from cultural and ethical criticism to partisan debate. I think liberals very often can agree with almost everything many conservative critics have said, particularly on cultural matters.
Right. Not that they would ever admit to that in the papers. Ooh. Either side.
Well, no, because I mean the demands of kind of ding dong, you know, black and white, bad example, bad choice of words. You know, the ding dong of party politics, of course. But if you're an intellectual, if you're an opinion writer, you have to be a little subtler.
On aesthetics, why do you think conservatives keep going back to beauty and truth and goodness? Why is there that continual resonance? Is that just Burke did it, so we have to keep going in that vein? It's not that liberals don't.
Burke is great, by the way. He's much better on aesthetics, the beauty and the sublime, than he is on politics.
Sure.
I don't know really whether that's true. I mean, what is true that somehow conservatives, they certainly don't have a monopoly on good aesthetic writing.
Sure.
You know, one of the great philosophers, aesthetic philosophers, Richard Vollheim. He was far from conservative. You could multiply examples. In France, conservative writers in the 1920s and 30s tended to be better than writers on the left. At other times, you can think of writers who were better on the left than writers on the right. I feel politics is very specific. It's very historical. It's anchored in places and times. And it's terribly tempting to import a lot of philosophy or aesthetics into it, and vice versa, to import partisan political categories into philosophy and aesthetics. If I could leave your listeners with any thought, it's that when thinking about politics, you have to keep ideas, culture, aesthetics in mind, but you must remember the limits of either and respect each of them.
Well, that is a great place to stop, and something that as a conservative, I 100% agree with.
Well, I'm glad to agree.
I also assume we both agree that this is a fantastic book and that our listeners should go out and pick it up and read it. And I intend to get your book on liberalism, and I'd love to have you back on if you're willing for a conversation about that once I get it finished. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Glad to have been with you.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking, that ribbon of high